What kind of day is it? It's a White Claw day. Light and refreshing tasting. Uniquely cold wave filter. There's an iconic flavor for everyone. Come on, grab a pack. White Claw. Grab life by the claw. Please drink responsibly. Hard seltzer with flavor. White Claw seltzer works Chicago, Illinois.
Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 Bacon Bundle. Because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the Bacon Cheese Slider, 1921 Bacon Cheese Slider, or Chicken Bacon Ranch Slider. And also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 Bacon Bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show on the Choose Yourself Network. Today on the James Altucher Show.
Herminia Ibarra, who's one of the people in Range who studies how people kind of triangulate their match quality, has this phrase I love: we learn who we are in practice, not in theory. And what she means is there's like a huge industry of personality tests and gurus that kind of preach them and commencement speeches that tell you introspect and decide who you're going to be and then go forth and be that. And in fact, what all the evidence shows is that you actually have to try stuff to learn about yourself and then reflect on it. And you know, this end of history illusion, this idea that we all underestimate how much we're going to change. We only learn about ourselves by doing things, reflecting on it, and then continually zigzagging and triangulating your match quality. And honestly, I think this really resonated with some of the things I thought you wrote, where you gave people the advice to sort of focus on what was in front of them, where they sometimes look like way ahead at some idealized goal and they're not looking at the step right in front of them and learning from it as they're sort of zigzagging their way there.
Yeah, right. Like my view is it's almost nonsensical to have 1 year, 5 year, 10 year goals. You could have them with the understanding that it's only to be used to determine what you're going to do today. Because if I learn something new today, that could completely change my 5 year goal. So I'm so excited to have this next guest on. I had taken a little break from, even though we always release two podcasts a week, I took a little break from recording these just so I could catch up on my reading. And I really wanted to read this book called Range, Why Generalists Triumph in a Specialized World. And I got so excited reading the book. I searched through my emails to see if I knew him, and it turned out several people had tried to introduce me to him, and then I found out you were in town. So David Epstein, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me. I feel very lucky that that worked out.
No, it's great, and this is an area I'm fascinated with, which is everyone always says, oh, it takes 10,000 hours to be like a master of something or to be a peak performer. And I just know through all my experiences and the hundreds of peak performers I've had on the podcast that just didn't, and I've even had Anders Ericsson, the creator of the 10,000 hour rule, on the podcast, and I've been talking with him recently about this. It just didn't feel right to me. And your book kind of gathered everything together why the 10,000 hour rule doesn't always work. Maybe to start this off, describe the story about Vincent Van Gogh that you talk about here, because I thought that was such a great story.
Oh, so basically, well, I don't reveal that it's Vincent Van Gogh at first, but I just tell the story.
I'm sorry, I was a spoiler. No, it was a great part way you wrote this, but
no, it's just tell the story of this young man who at first is actually quite a promising student, and so is sent away to a fancy boarding school where he doesn't like being away from home that much, and comes back and is sort of listless, doesn't really know what to do. He loves walking, loves looking at nature, isn't really sure what else to do. Uncle has started a very fancy art dealership, and so it gives him a job as in an art store. Basically.
And he had no artistic talent at this point either.
No, in fact, he had tried drawing as a kid. His mother was into the arts and music, and he tried drawing as a kid, and he would trace like with something under the paper, but then when he tried to draw freehand, he did it so poorly that he decided just to quit and never do it again. He tried to draw the family cat, basically, and decided never to draw again.
So what does that indicate to you? Does that indicate lack of interest, lack of talent, lack of skill?
It's a good question. I mean, if you look at his early drawings, you would not identify him as someone who was going to become that good. So I certainly don't think, you know, one of the things I've written about before is this very wide range of responsiveness to certain types of training, which is sort of one of the problems I've had with the 10,000 hour rule, because it shows up in every study that two people doing the same exact training often become more different, not more the same. They get different results from the exact same training. And so you wouldn't have picked him as someone who was going to go on and do that. So I think there was a lack of baseline talent, but maybe an ability to respond to certain types of training. But also I think he just had a kind of also crippling perfectionism about it in some ways early on.
So he sort of looked at this drawing. He said, oh, I suck. It's not worth getting, even though everyone's going to be bad at their first attempt at anything, he just couldn't handle it.
Pretty much. And he had other stuff that he was really into. So it wasn't like, he was trying to fill his time. He was super into collecting like bugs and birds, and he could walk for like hours and just watch, water bugs for 3 hours doing their commute across streams, and he would collect birds' nests. So he had plenty of stuff to do. So it wasn't like he was lacking for things. So it was no problem. Like, I suck at this. Okay, I'm going to go do something else.
And then what happened?
So when he comes back and he goes and works in an art dealership, and he loves it at first because it's just like collecting. So he'd been collecting all these things, and now he starts collecting prints. And collage was becoming this very important form. And so people would come in, he'd say like, help them with their collage books and all these things. And he writes his parents and says, I'll never need another job again and all this sort of stuff. But slowly things, by the time he's 20, he's getting sent abroad to meet like really important customers. But then he slowly starts to have sort of conflicts. He doesn't really like bargaining with customers. He feels like it's sort of taking advantage of them, and he starts to develop sort of strong opinions, and his boss is kind of like, sell them stuff. Like, don't have opinions that are contrary to them. And he was a country kid, and his boss was this urbane guy, and they didn't get along that well. And so eventually he gets sent out to work where he doesn't really have to interact with customers. He's this incredibly hard worker. Like everywhere he goes, people admire his work ethic. He's there before them. He's there after them. And so sometimes, people, they get there after Vincent, they leave before Vincent. And eventually he just sort of keeps deteriorating his sort of relationships with his boss. And so he has to, he leaves that career, basically. He goes back home, goes through a series of other jobs. He's a teacher. And each time he has another job, he thinks that's the last job because he works so hard. And he says, I found my thing. I'm going to hit it hard. He has his 10,000 hours mindset, and he'll tell his parents, like, I've found it. I'm good. And he ends up leaving, like something doesn't go right.
So he is passionate about it. He doesn't do anything that he's not passionate about.
Oh, he has so much passion. Like when he dives into teaching, that's his passion. And he does tutoring. And then he decides he wants to become he's a bookseller for a little while, and he loves reading, absolutely adores reading. So he loves that because he can be in the store and he can read. And again, his coworkers marvel at his endurance, where the bookstore flooded one time and they all sort of tire out, and he's going back and forth like saving books from the floodwaters, and they like left these notes about how amazing his endurance was. But again, he sort of doesn't get along with the customers always that well, and kind of like flames out on it, even though he thinks it's his calling. And he decides to follow his father's footsteps into the clergy, right? And so he first has to get, now he has to go back and finish university education so he can train to be a clergyman. So he gets a tutor. And once again, he has a hat that he like wax seals candles onto so he can read and study all night. And his landlord would find him awake at night. And he said, finally, I found my calling. He starts copying the text of entire textbooks over, and it turns out that like Greek and Latin don't come very easily to him. And it is one of his uncles, who's a war hero, just keeps telling him, just push on, push on. And so he tries, but again, he's not doing well. And so he sort of flames out in that, but he still wants to be religious. He still wants to spread the word. So he joins a shorter program where you don't have to go to university, but you're oriented toward sermonizing, basically giving talks. And it turns out that he's not good at concision in those talks. Like he likes to sort of talk at length. So he fails out of that program as well. And he says, fine, nobody can stop me from spreading the word. So he decides to become like an itinerant catechist, goes to the most downtrodden area called the Borinage, this area in Europe, where it's coal country, essentially. And it's so, the working conditions are so bad that the workers refer to earth level above the mines as up in hell. And he gets there right after this incredible disaster that like basically blows to bits like 120 miners. And so there's incredible work to do in consoling people. And this is where he's good. He's so passionate, and he gives them all of his clothes. He gives them all of his money and possessions and dotes on the ill and injured day and night. And then he's great. But when things get sort of back to normal and he has to kind of run a ministry, he's awkward. And he's not that good at giving those sermons, and the kids think he's kind of weird and these sorts of things. So that gets closed also. He makes one more try in sort of a swamp to be a preacher, and that doesn't work out either. And with nothing else, when he's in the Borinage and seeing these coal miners, he thinks back to his art selling days and says, "Gosh, you know, if Rembrandt had seen like these blackened skies here, he really could have done something with this. Too bad, like there's nobody here to draw the life out here, because if there were an artist here, they'd really be able to do something." And so, having flamed out in five different careers and having no possessions and in this coal country, he doesn't know what to do, and he just starts drawing the people around him, and he starts to like that. And he picks up at the age of 27 a book called The Guide to the ABCs of Drawing and starts learning how to draw or trying to draw, but he is not that good at drawing figures, at drawing proportions, but he likes it. And he starts writing letters to his brother and say, like, send me some supplies and all these sorts of things. And this starts his sort of artistic career, and he tries to get some formal training. But when he goes to an art academy at about the age of 33, he finishes last in a class competition and is recommended to revert to a class with 10-year-olds because he's not that good at sort of realistic drawing, flames out in everything he does. Actually, if you go to his Wikipedia page, Anton Mauve is listed as his education, who was one of his cousins by marriage. He spent 3 weeks with Mauve trying to learn watercolors, and he couldn't control them that well and so quit. So his education listed on Wikipedia is a guy he spent 3 weeks with, basically. Finally, he decides, you know, he keeps sort of experimenting. I'm giving you the long version here, obviously. Just as he did between jobs, where he dives in and says, this is the way to do it, this is the path, this is the final thing for me, he does that with artistic experimentation. He says, drawing humans, drawing figures is the only thing an artist should do, that everything else is nonsense. And then he tries to do it, and he's not that good at it, and he says, drawing figures is nonsense. Artists should only try to draw nature. That's where you really capture something. And then maybe if he's not that good at that, he goes to something else. He says, there are no such thing as color. There's only shades of black and white. I will use no colors, only black. And he does this painting, The Potato Eaters, that's like so dark you can barely see it. And later on, he decides, never mind that. There's not even black in the night sky. It's only shades of blue and purple. And he bounces between all these experiments. And one day, he decides to drag some oil paints, where he's never used before, out to a beach in a storm and an easel. And he has to run in and out of cover because he's getting sandblasted like with the storm, and he has to slap the oil paint on really quickly, and his oil paint is all gloopy, and so he's suddenly free of this crippling perfectionism because he has to go whoosh, whoosh, whoosh. And he looks at that painting when it's done and writes to Theo, his brother, and says, painting has proven easier than I expected the first time, and this painting is actually one that was stolen and then recovered a decade later, and the painting's amazing. And he starts to go with that kind of impetuous style where he's not slowing down as much. Now, if you even look at his canvases closely, you can see canvas between the strokes because he's going so fast. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that kind of freed him from that crippling perfectionism he had. And he merged all these kind of experiments that he had dived in and out of into this totally unique style. And everything we know of him, he does in basically the last 2 years of his life. If he had died, he died at 37. If he had died at 34, he would maybe be a historical footnote. And so, yeah, that's the really long version, but you seem still interested in it.
Yeah, so that one, so there's a lot of points from your book that covers. One is that having passions in a variety of areas could lend themselves to being, you know, really a genius at some intersection of these passions, or maybe in a new passion, which kind of draws from different elements. Like clearly, his paintings have almost this religious style intensity, and he had a lot of experience of looking at a variety of painting styles when he was working for an art dealership. I don't know what the book selling contributed to him, but.
Well, he continued to be a voracious reader, and in a lot of his paintings, you'll see like Zola novels open. And so he would sometimes take themes from Zola from Emile Zola when he decided what to paint. So it sort of contributed to some of his inspiration. If nothing else.
So, and then I want to compare that story to some of the classic areas where the 10,000-hour rule does apply. Put a thumbtack in that one for a second, and then let's take something like the violin or chess, where like Anders Ericsson famously does this study of a group of violinists, where the ones who studied for, you know, 10,000 hours became the best violinists in the world. The ones who studied 8,000 hours were a little bit below them, and the ones who studied 5,000 hours became like, you know, teachers of violin rather than performers of violin. And so that was kind of this – classic 10,000 hour rule scenario. Or chess, you mentioned the Polgar sisters in the book. That was like almost like this weird experiment on this guy's children. Laszlo Polgar basically from birth on just taught his kids chess, just like Tiger Woods' dad just taught him golf, and everything else was sort of to the side. They got their 10,000 hours really quickly at an age when the brain was forming. So, boom, they became kind of the some of the best chess players in history, and certainly the best the three best women in history. And what do you see as the difference between chess and art? I know they're very different, but like how do you see that you could be a peak performer in one that requires the 10,000 hours and this other one doesn't require the 10,000 hours?
Yeah, so I think they're the way I kind of write about that in Range is they're in different places on this spectrum of what the psychologist Robin Hogarth calls the kind versus wicked learning environments, basically. And a kind learning environment is an area where there's lots of information available, particularly information about previous attempts. There are rigid rules. All pertinent information is available. Patterns repeat. People often take turns. Next steps are what you're trying to, goals are clear. And you get feedback after attempts that is immediate and perfectly accurate. And so that is something like golf, right, where it's almost like people who study skill acquisition almost classify it as like an industrial task where you're trying to do the same thing over and over with as little deviation as possible.
Right, and you could say there's like a finite number of what I call micro skills in golf. So there's putting, there's that first drive, there's whatever. I don't play golf, but let's just take putting. You know, you can practice the same thing over and over again. And if you do what Anders calls deliberate practice, where you putt, it doesn't make it. A teacher tells you what you did wrong. Now you practice again. You don't make it. A teacher tells you what you did wrong, and you keep adjusting and mm-hmm. adjusting. You do that for 10,000 hours, you'll be the best putter in the world and mm-hmm. among the best golfers in the world.
Yeah, and so and even other domains like chess are sort of on the kinder end of the spectrum because they're based on pattern recognition, right? Like one of the things that specialists are great at is recognizing previous patterns. And it's also one of the reasons why computers are really good at chess, because they're good in domains where there are a lot of patterns. On the other end of the spectrum are the wicked learning environments where some information isn't clear, next steps may not be clear, goals may be more amorphous, feedback is usually not automatic, and if it is, it might be delayed and it may be partially inaccurate. So one of the examples Hogarth uses that I love is this New York City physician who got really famous because time and again he could predict that a patient was going to get typhoid before they showed any symptoms, and he would do it by palpating their tongue, you know, feeling around their tongue with his hands. And over before they showed a single symptom, he predicts this and becomes very famous for that. And as one of his colleagues later said, he was a more productive carrier of typhoid than even Typhoid Mary, using only his hands. So what he was the one transferring the typhoid, but kept getting it right. And so this feedback reinforced the exact wrong lesson, right? And so that's the epitome of a wicked learning environment. Most of us aren't there either, but we're somewhere between those poles. And the more you're on the kind end, the more the 10,000 hours makes sense. And the more you're on the wicked end, the less it makes sense.
It's funny though how, like, let's take violin, chess, maybe math, golf, all these areas that are probably on the kind end, people do associate with, you know, this kind of, you know, maybe music is there. People associate with these like kind of glamorous stories of prodigies mm-hmm. and intelligence, and, you know, like the better you are at chess, it's assumed the more intelligent you are. If you're great at music at the age of 9, like Mozart was, it's assumed he was this brilliant prodigy. Like, it's an amazing thing. Same with math or violin or whatever. And Tiger Woods was considered a prodigy of golf. Whereas these other things, the wicked domains, Vincent van Gogh obviously wasn't a prodigy of art. In fact, he gave up. But the other thing that's different, though, about art, let's say, as opposed to chess, there's rules, and you either win or lose. There's a one or a zero. Whereas art, there's no such thing as winning or losing. In fact, what Van Gogh did was he kind of almost created a new form of art. Like art, many of these wicked domains, the domain itself changes as a result of a new peak performer. Like Picasso with Cubism, he changed art. He didn't become great necessarily at the old school. He created his new school.
No, that's a great point. I mean, what Van Gogh did changed what artists do, as did Picasso, right? He was a bridge between eras, basically. And that's not the same kind of goal as golf. And it resonates with me a lot to you say it that way, because before this, I wrote a book called The Sports Gene about genetics and athleticism and was invited to a lot of conferences that I didn't really know existed and asked to essentially extrapolate from sports to any other challenges that people faced in the world, whatever business challenge or personal challenge it was. And there are lessons you can learn from sports for other areas, but sports is very constrained and totally zero sum. And most of the things that we care about aren't that way. They're not zero sum. They're not based on repetitive patterns and sort of choreographed skills and things like that. So I started to feel, you know, a little self-conscious about whether I should do it or not, because I think we've made a lot of inappropriate extrapolations from these zero sum environments, you know, where you have to have a winner and where you have these really constrained rules to areas where that's not at all the case.
Yeah, you figure there's a lot of areas in life that people want to be the best in the world at, or let's say in the top 1%, like let's say, for instance, investing. But investing's an area where, again, the one and the zero is a little blurrier. There, yes, you could make money or lose money, but that doesn't necessarily tell you whether you did well or not. Like, you know, you have to make money. You know, sometimes you can make a lot of money. Sometimes you can make a little money. Sometimes a bad decision will make you a lot of money. Mm-hmm. You know, as you've probably read Annie Duke's Thinking and Bets. Mm-hmm. So where she says sometimes a decision that where the outcome is mostly bad could actually be a good decision if you keep doing it and the final outcome is very good. So some of these areas are a little more, or some of these areas where we want to be good at are all wicked domains, as opposed to, you know, these very specific domains like chess or violin or some of these very narrow things that have a very specific either one or zero outcome.
That's right. And so this is kind of the core of a debate between two of the most famous scholars of expertise, Gary Klein and Daniel Kahneman. And what they were noticing was that as they were studying experienced performers, Klein's results were showing, wow, people really get a lot better with practice and with repetition of the same thing over and over and over. And what Kahneman's research was showing something very different, that, wow, people get a lot more confident but not any better with experience. And so they came together to do this amazing paper, I think, in terms of conceptually that they called an adversarial collaboration. They got together and said, why are we seeing such different results if we're kind of approaching the same things? And it turned out that it was domain dependent, right? The domains that Klein was studying were these domains where there were very repetitive patterns. So he would look at, you know, firefighters who worked on house fires only. But then if they ended up in a larger building, they were actually stripped of that expertise and could make very bad decisions as long as they stayed in the same domain.
But what if they were firefighters that their domain was all sorts of buildings? Would they still need the 10,000 hours to be an overall good firefighter?
That's a great question, because I mentioned sort of a classic research finding in Range that is summarized as breadth of training predicts breadth of transfer. And this is sort of one of my critiques of some kind of 10,000 hour thinking. What that means, transfer is what psychologists say, meaning the ability to take your skills and knowledge and use it in situations you've never seen before, which is ultimately what you want to do if you're in a less predictable environment. And the broadness of the challenges that you face early in training helps you build these sort of conceptual models and general skills that allow you to do transfer. So one of the examples I use in the book is people being trained on how to respond to like naval threats. And there's one group that's trained on a certain type of threat over and over and over, then the next type over and over and over, then the next type over and over and over, and another group that never sees the same scenario twice. And group two is totally frustrated, and they don't feel like they learned anything. And then when they bring them back much later and show them all new scenarios, group two destroys group one. Hmm. So even though they're not even seeing scenarios they've ever seen before, it's like that kind of training, broad training, forces you, instead of learning how to execute procedures, how to match strategies to problems. And that's what you want. So I don't know that anybody's done this, but one of the ways that wilderness firefighters, I have a chapter late in the book talks about wilderness firefighters and some of the problems they face when they face unexpected challenges. Some of the updates to their training have been varying the training environments, actually. This is kind of new, so it's hard to know if that's really worked.
But I wonder if this is covered by, just playing devil's advocate, I wonder if this is covered by Anders Ericsson's deliberate practice, where, you know, the mentor kind of creates the environments, you know, so that you practice in all these different environments and you get feedback from a teacher and you do over and over again. And you even discuss interleaving of different environments for one domain to kind of get overall better. So I wonder if this is a little covered by that and we're still under the 10,000 hour rule.
I think it is a little covered in that, in the sense that, in my opinion, everything is covered by deliberate practice at this point because the definition has become so amorphous. Mm-hmm. So the best I can tell, in the original definition, if you look at the original paper, it says doing the same thing or something similar repeatedly. But now it seems to me the definition has become that which in retrospect did cause someone to improve. And if that's the definition, then you've left the science realm, and that's not really a hypothesis. So when I've talked to Anders about this, and I say, you know, here, look at this study of people who are trained in the exact same way and have these incredible variability of responses and get more different. He says, well, they're not elite, so you can't talk about them. And then first of all, if you can't start with square zero, you don't have a comprehensive model of skill development, period. So if you can only start with people who are finished product and look backward, and then you look at those people, and even in the 10,000 hour study, he didn't include measures of variance in that study, right? So I invited him to a conference and asked him about it, and his first answer was, well, that doesn't really matter because the subjects were inconsistent in multiple accounts of their practice hours.
So let me just understand that. So let's take the violin example. He was just studying violinists that were already in like violin academy or
right.
whatever.
Highly pre-selected. Serious restriction of range problem. There.
And I think you mentioned an example in here where there was someone was started playing the violin at 18 and became an elite player. So what was different there? What was happening?
I mean, that wasn't someone who studied. That's just someone whose sort of story I know. But in the people that Anders picked, they were pre-select. They were already in a world-famous music academy. And by the way, some of them did not reach 10,000 hours. There was high variance that he didn't report, but he told me that it's at least 500 hours. So some people went over and some people went under, and 10,000 was just an average. So like we talked about the chess master and scholar Fernand Gobet before, and one of his studies that looks at, you know, people on route to international master status in chess, some people make it in 3,000 hours. Some were at 25,000 in the study and didn't make it. So you could, if you averaged it, there was 11,053 hours on average to reach international master status. But an 11,053 hour rule doesn't tell you anything about the real breadth of human variation that runs from 3,000 to we don't even know where yet because some people stopped at 25,000.
Is that where talent plays a role?
I think, yes, mm-hmm. I think it does. Talent plays a role, and also the right kind of training, which I guess you can call deliberate practice if anything that works qualifies as deliberate practice. But that to me means that it's like not that useful anymore. And I think there's a lot of evidence that instead of just starting on your 10,000 hours, it's really important to try to maximize your match quality, where that's the term economists use for the degree of fit between your abilities and your interests and what you do. And very important for your motivation, for your apparent grit, for your performance. And you get more bang for your effort if you work on maximizing your match quality.
So describe match quality.
So match quality is just this fit between who you are and what you do, basically, and your interests and abilities and what it is that you end up doing.
But Van Gogh thought he had match quality in like five different domains.
That's right.
And then stumbled into this sixth domain almost by chance.
Yeah.
And that was his real match quality. So it's not like sort of, that also isn't an area where it's measurable. Like I can.
That's right.
Do a blood test and find out what area I'm going to qualify the most at.
No, that's a great point. In fact, Herminia Ibarra, who's one of the people in range who studies how people kind of triangulate their match quality, has this phrase I love: we learn who we are in practice, not in theory. And what she means is there's like a huge industry of personality tests and gurus that kind of preach them, and commencement speeches that tell you introspect and decide who you're going to be and then go forth and be that. And in fact, what all the evidence shows is that you actually have to try stuff to learn about yourself and then reflect on it. And you know, this end of history illusion, this idea that we all underestimate how much we're going to change. We only learn about ourselves by doing things, reflecting on it, and then continually zigzagging and triangulating your match quality. And honestly, I think this really resonated with some of the things I thought you wrote, where you gave people the advice to sort of focus on what was in front of them, where they sometimes look like way ahead at some idealized goal and they're not looking at the step right in front of them and learning from it as they're sort of zigzagging their way there.
Yeah, right. Like my view is it's almost nonsensical to have 1 year, 5 year, 10 year goals. You could have them with the understanding that it's only to be used to determine what you're going to do today. Because if I learn something new today, that can completely change my 5 year goal. Like if I learn something about, let's say I'm trying to get good at investing, but I learn something today about investing that is X versus what I thought I was going to learn because by definition, I don't know what I'm going to know tomorrow. where I think I'm going to be in 5 years can completely change.
I mean, you'd be like an ideal subject in the Dark Horse Project that's in there, right? This study at Harvard that studies how people find careers where they feel fulfilled. And it's called the Dark Horse Project because it wasn't called that originally, because the people that come in from all these, you know, some are investors, piano tuners, midwives, some are wealthy, some are not. So fulfillment was more the dependent variable there. And they all come in and say, well, don't do what I did because, you know, I did all this other stuff first and I didn't find it until later and I zigzagged and I thought I was going to be this and I ended up as that. So don't tell anybody to do what I did. So they all view themselves as coming from behind, you know, coming out of nowhere like a dark horse. But their common trait is this kind of short-term planning where instead of looking around and say, this person's got more than me and is younger than me and setting these long goals, they say, here's who I am today. Here are my skills. Here are my interests. Here are the opportunities right in front of me. This seems like the best one to try. My hypothesis about what I'll learn and accomplish is this. And then maybe a year from now, I'll change because I will have learned something about myself. They don't jump ahead, do that thing that, you know, Paul Graham called premature optimization, basically setting the goal before you know anything. So, I think basically you intuitively came to the conclusions that those researchers came to through other means.
I have to say, Airbnb has changed my life. I just love staying in Airbnbs. Like in about a month, I'm going to Cocoa Beach, which is right next to Cape Canaveral. I'm going to watch some rocket launches. I'm going to, of course, be staying in a very nice Airbnb on the beach. And it's just such a great experience. Like the whole world is available to us now because of Airbnb. But whenever I'm at an Airbnb, I always realize, you know, the home that I left to come to this Airbnb, I could be making money on that right now by hosting and being an Airbnb myself. So, and I've known people, I had a friend who basically, you know, made a living from turning his home into an Airbnb. So if you have a home, but you're not always at home, you do have an Airbnb there. And it can easily fit into your lifestyle. And it's a great way to earn some money. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. The famous Abraham Lincoln quote says, good things come to those who wait. I wonder, did he really say that? Jay, did he really say that? Can you look that up? Regardless of who said it, that's only part of the quote. The full quote is, good things come to those who wait, but only the things left by those who hustle. Well, if you're a business owner and want the best people on your team, the same applies. And listen, I've interviewed 1,500 people now and a lot of entrepreneurs. I can safely say the one thing consistent among all entrepreneurs and CEOs, the successful ones, is that it's all about the people you surround yourself. If you hire well, you're going to have a great business. And, you know, thankfully, ZipRecruiter puts the hustle in your hiring. So you find qualified candidates fast. This is so important. And I want you to try it. You could try it as a potential employer or employee. You could try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter's smart technology finds top talent for your roles right away. Immediately after you post your job, if you're hiring, ZipRecruiter's matching technology starts showing you qualified people for it. And I will tell you that I signed up on ZipRecruiter as a potential employee. You know, I just wanted to see how it works. And right away, it started matching me with really amazing potential employers. So give it a try at ZipRecruiter.com/James. Let ZipRecruiter give you the hiring hustle you need. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/James to try it for free. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
Well, and then here's the other thing. This was my original question for Anders more recently when we exchanged some emails, and you just addressed it with the talent or the skill transference. You know, like for instance, I've done a lot of public speaking and I've done a lot of writing. So I've done, you can argue I've put in 10,000 hours worth of communicating and even communicating humorously because my talks are people laugh and my writing people laugh. But I started doing stand-up comedy and I was really curious how much I can pull from those 10,000 hours into this completely new area and how far an area has to be before those hours of skill are no longer useful. And your argument a little bit is that they're always useful to some extent. Like Van Gogh takes from book selling and he becomes a great painter. And it seems like the more wicked the domain, the further out in domains you can go to be a peak performer in the domain you really want to establish peak performance in.
I think that's right. I think that's generally a good rubric.
And like Maria is a great example. Mutual friend Maria Konnikova, who's taken a year and she was already like a poker champion.
She didn't even know like how many cards were in a deck, I don't think.
Yeah, she didn't know the rules of poker
ago.
At all.
Yeah.
And, but we talked about this. She was able to borrow from, you know, all her studying of Sherlock Holmes and con men, you know, doing a PhD on this stuff. Her ability to observe people, she was able to take some of those 10,000 hours and move them into the poker domain.
I mean, in some ways, she's like the least surprising human on earth to become a pro poker player quickly, right? Like if for someone who knows her. But that's, I mean, there's a good analogy from that in sports. Like in the Australian Institute of Sports, studied athletes that have done multiple invasion sports when they're younger. Those are the ones that are happening in real time where you're like trying to get by people. And they require these skills of anticipating things before they happen because it's actually occurring too fast for you to react to. And
so like what's an example sport like that?
Oh, like basketball, volleyball, tennis, soccer yeah, football. And the athletes who had done more of those when they were younger, then their threshold for how many hours they needed to become elite in any subsequent one was lowered by a lot. So they would start making national teams at 3,000 hours and things like that if they had this broad base early on. So it seems to like, you know, build some scaffolding for learning these later skills more quickly. And I would say Maria had a pretty good scaffolding for becoming a pro poker player.
But at the same time, like you mentioned Roger Federer, the tennis player, and how he started late in life and he'd done a bunch of racket sports, which it sort of is like what you're just saying now. He did a bunch of racket sports.
He'd done a bunch of sports, period.
But wouldn't you say that 10,000 hours of deliberate practice helps in tennis where, okay, now we're going to practice all day the serve. And, okay, the teacher's going to say, no, adjust this way, adjust that way. Now we're going to do the backhand, now the forehand. And wouldn't you say the 10,000 hours, and if you start really young, it builds the right, you know, myelin sheaths in your brain and everything to make a great tennis player?
That is what I would have said until I sort of started investigating it more deeply. And yes to some of that, but the reason I was looking into this was kind of because I was the science writer at Sports Illustrated and I saw, you know, youth specialization proceeding in sports and decided to say, you know, let's look at what science says about optimal development. And you see this almost every sport, or in certainly in all the more dynamic sports, that the athletes who go on to become elite have this so-called sampling period where they play a variety of sports, they get this broad array of general skills, they learn about their interests and abilities and systematically delay specializing until later than their peers. And when I saw that, I said, okay, well, that's probably just because they're more talented, so they can play a bunch of sports before they specialize. So then I moved to the next level and started finding these studies where researchers would match athletes for ability at a certain age, track them for several years, and see who improved more. And in a certain age range, it was the kids who did more other sports and less of the sport they were targeting. So I do think there's a point where you have to focus, but I think it's pretty clear that this unstructured non-feedback, right? So France, which just won the World Cup, overhauled their development system some years ago to not let coaches talk most of the time when kids are playing. A French kid who's good at soccer plays about half as many formal games as an American kid. And the saying that they use in their development is there's no remote control. The coach should not try to micromanage them and give them that feedback all the time because you want to start first playing in this unstructured manner. Similarly with the national team members that won the previous World Cup to that in Germany, not until they were 22 years old did they start doing more structured play than amateur level players, but they had a bigger background of this unstructured play. So again, if you want to fit unstructured play into deliberate practice, then like anything fits, but I certainly don't think it fits the original definition.
And let's you know, you don't talk that much about music in the book, but let's say any form of modern music. It seems like that's a very wicked domain.
Yeah.
And it's similar to art in the sense that every decade, music means something different than the decade before. Like, there's new forms of music that develop. So just because you were good at the old form or practice over, doesn't have anything to do with the training that makes you... Like, let's say someone was a really great musician in the 1970s. They started young. They learned the piano or the violin or whatever. Doesn't necessarily make them automatically going to be good as a hip-hop, you know, rapper in the 80s. So, again, that seems like, you know, this is a creative area that makes a lot of money and creates a lot of success, but that the domain, the meaning of the domain changes constantly.
I agree. And I should preface this, since I'm being critical, that I like Anders a lot.
Hopefully that goes without saying. I like him a lot too. And I think what I'm sort of driving at is that in some cases, some domains require wicked abilities. In some cases, they require kind abilities. Like, let's just take rap as an example. Sometimes maybe you need 10,000 hours of singing, and now we're going to take in the rules of rap, which we just learned a day ago, and combine them, and that might create this whole new form.
Right. You're doing something new, right? So there isn't that, like, coach telling you exactly what to do because you're trying to do something somebody else hasn't done. It's a wicked problem. And I think it's sort of telling that the Cambridge Handbook of Expertise, which is like the Bible for the 10,000 hour school, it's like 1,000 pages long with like giant pages and tiny type. And it has a full chapter on music, and it's all classical music. Then there's like two sentences that has a couple citations and says, and in all the other forms of music, there's actually sampling early and they specialize later. And it's just like a write-off. I'm like, how can you? So they're only looking at like the most kind environment where it's not really creative work, it's recreative work that they're doing. And so I think that's kind of telling and important.
Well, one time we had on the podcast two guests in a row the same day. One was a guy who was a humor writer. He writes jokes for shows, but he doesn't perform. He's just, all he's been doing is writing jokes, and they're great, and he's well mm-hmm. known for it. And then later on we had a well-known stand-up comedian. And so the joke writer said he was like right away able to, he started late in life, like his college years, but he was right away funny and able to, he doesn't even think he's improved at all since day one. Now, he probably had a lot of interests along the way. Mm-hmm, he was a very mm-hmm. smart guy. He was going to like the best schools. But he said it didn't require him any time at all to sort of find his voice. The stand-up comedian, on the other hand, said she took at least 8 or 9 years before she even considered that she was just beginning. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if this is a combination of both wicked and kind. So the wicked part is maybe being humorous, and the kind part that requires 10,000 hours is maybe stage time and seeing maybe thousands of different types of audiences and kind of cataloging them in your brain and seeing how they react to different things. I don't know. I'm just kind of around.
No, I've started to, since reading that work about kind and wicked learning environments, I've started to sort of analyze the world in that way. Like, which parts of this endeavor are the kind parts where I can kind of have this built-in feedback and sort of repetitive challenges where it does make sense to maybe follow that kind of more deliberate practice model, and which are the parts where that doesn't really make sense because it's varied and I have to do something new, and the perfect way to do it isn't even clear at all. And so I think breaking down those domains, what you're doing, I think, is very much what Gary Klein and Daniel Kahneman were doing, which is saying, like, well, why is this approach working here and totally backfiring here? And so I think that's an exactly right way to look. I mean, I agree with you.
And so I wonder then, like, so I'm over 50. I want to be, let's say, a great musician. Maybe let's say anybody says, I want to be a great entrepreneur. I want to be a great salesperson. I want to be a great investor. So anybody starting later in life that says to themselves, well, I can't put in the 10,000 hours to be a master of something. Maybe the challenge is, okay, what are the areas in my life that I've gotten pretty good at in the past? How can I combine them? Like, what does the intersection look like? Even if I can't define it exactly, I could define it roughly. And then here's the domain I really want to be a peak performer in. What new domain can I birth out of the domain that I really want to be good at? So then I could be the best at this new thing I've created that's very so ancillary to the domain I want to be good at that it seems like the same.
Yeah, that's sort of like skill stacking concept, right? You're not the best at anything, but if you can kind of create your own turf to compete on. And that that one that just resonates with me very much personally, because it turned out the most valuable thing for me to become a senior writer at Sports Illustrated was having gone to grad school in geology, right? Which I could not have picked out first, but I took something where I was a quite ordinary scientist, but an extraordinary scientist for a sports publication, right? And so it was the combination of those things that just like shot me past all the other people who were sort of working up one step at a time. And one of my favorite examples is a guy in Rangers, Gunpei Yokoi, a Japanese man who didn't score well in his electronics exam. So he had to take kind of a low-tier job with a playing card company as a machine maintenance worker. Totally realized he wasn't equipped to work on the cutting edge, which is why he had to go to this company in Kyoto while all his friends went to Tokyo. But that there was so much information now available that everyone was skipping over, that if he just looked more broadly, he could just combine all this old cheap stuff into new things that nobody had seen. And he did that and started a toy and game operation at that playing card company called Nintendo. And then he combined a whole bunch of old technologies to make the Game Boy, which was the best-selling video game console of the 20th century. And his philosophy that he called lateral thinking with withered technology. Withered technology, he meant stuff that's already well understood. So you don't have to worry about the specialists, and lateral thinking, just bringing things together that aren't usually together, that became the core philosophy of Nintendo, basically. And I think he's representative of this trend, this research I mentioned, like in technological patents, where the creators who make the biggest impact are the ones, not the ones who've drilled the deepest, who are useful, totally essential for certain problems, but the ones who have spread their work across the largest number of technological domains as classified by the U.S. Patent Office. And in that research, that trend has really basically accelerated since like the early 90s. So I don't think it was always like this. I think before that, it made more sense to be more narrow. And I think, well, I don't think, I'm taking the idea from the researcher, that communication technology, as we can disseminate specialist information so rapidly and so thoroughly, there's many more opportunities for people to do that kind of lateral thinking, combine things that specialists can't see, than there are just to kind of push the cutting edge forward.
Right. So just to summarize that research, that was the research which basically said, it measured which scientific achievements had the longest lasting kind of impact on either society or the field or whatever. And it looked like early on, the people who specialized the most, meaning all the work they cited was still within their same domain, it looked like those were the ones that were accomplishing the most. But then if you look out over years, it was the scientists who cited as many references or many sources as possible from completely different domains, that those were the long-lasting accomplishments. Like, do you know an example? Like, that was the overall research, but is there a great example?
Atypical combinations of knowledge, those were called. And I mean, so some of the examples were like we learned basically a lot about how genes work from someone who was working on why certain flowers, when you make hybrids of certain white flowers, like why they turn out purple. And they were basically just combining things about inheritance with things about plant physiology that were very unusual. Had no idea that they were doing this, but it basically like revolutionized, you know, our understanding of genetics. And it was one of those papers where you had these two divergent domains where there was information that had never appeared together before. Came together, and those are the kind of papers you're talking about, where if you look 1 in 2 years, those papers are actually very low impact and end up in low impact journals usually. Like,
is that because like people think, oh, this is weird, I don't want to look at it? Because, you know, at that point it's very personality politics, you know, which papers get accepted to which conferences and so on.
Yeah, I mean, so interdisciplinary research and research that has atypical combinations of knowledge, which means it has like sources that have never appeared together in a reference, are systematically docked both in proposals and in when they're evaluated by reviewers. And as you might imagine, they are docked in ways that depend on those reviewers' expertise, right? They say, like, why this other thing? But once you zoom out to the 15-year window, those are the papers that actually have a much higher chance of becoming the smash hits. I mean, most papers, no matter what, don't become smash hits. But those ones have a much, much higher chance. But you have to extend that window. And I think that's partly because they're systematically disadvantaged, which is unfortunate. And even in spite of that, they end up rising to the top.
And your example is a great case study because, so again, you had this background in geology, which has probably zero intersection with sports. Like, there is nothing in common between geology
except
and sports.
Except for the Rocks for Jocks, like, class, right? That's like the intersection.
Right. And then there's sports, and then it's like, then there's this big domain, sports writing, but you kind of created your own little mini domain ancillary to sports writing, which is kind of scientific sports writing.
Yeah.
So there was nobody like you. So you were able to become the best at this domain that fell under sports writing, and you were able to rise up to the top in this sort of ancillary topic under the same umbrella.
Totally. I mean, it would not have happened if I were just competing on the same ground that everyone else was competing on. It was really this. I mean, I went into Sports Illustrated as a temp fact checker and became the youngest senior writer, and it had like everything to do with just having turf that no one else was competing with me on, right? By just like bringing together these skills of mine that if they were placed in isolation against the people who were the best at them, were somewhat ordinary, but in combination were unique.
Well, you know, and here's like, I think of two other sports writers. One's been on the podcast, the other one I'm a fan of, but Josh Foer, I forget if his background was as a sports writer or not, but, and then Stephen Fatsis, who wrote the book Word Freak.
Yeah, yeah.
So what's in common with both of them is that Josh, instead of just writing about the U.S. memory championships, and Stephen Fatsis, instead of just writing about the Scrabble world, they went in and Josh became the U.S. memory champion after training heavily. Stephen trained heavily in Scrabble. I don't think he became the U.S. Scrabble champion. He became a high-ranked Scrabble tournament player. So I think that by sort of doing this experiential type of writing, that also is its own domain within sports writing. Like, nobody can say, like, you're not going to say, okay, I'm going to write about basketball, but only after I play with the NBA for a while. Like, you're not going to do that. So you can't participate in that type of sports writing if you're going to write about basketball. But they picked areas where they were able to experience it, and that became this unique area of sports writing, which is, I'm going to do it and then write about it.
Yeah, no, totally. But I mean, most of what you see being in that industry is people who have a vision of someone else who they really liked as a writer, which is great. And you've written about this, right? Whether you know the person or not, they can be a role model for you. But maybe it's a mistake to try to be exactly what they are, right? And this is one of the guys I loved in the last chapter of Range, Oliver Smithies, who I interviewed shortly before he passed away. And the advice that he would give his students, who was just a wonderful guy, by the way, he was a Nobel laureate who he himself started as a medical student, saw a lecture in chemistry and was like, that's awesome. Started taking some chemistry and merged those at a time when biochemistry was like not a thing, right? So at that time, it was like, what are you doing? Like merging these things. Now it's its own, right? Eventually it becomes its own super specialty. But at the time, it was like this bold hybrid, and that gave him all this power. And he invented this technique that revolutionized biology. And then when he was in his mid-50s, he liked learning new domains. He took a sabbatical to go a full two floors away from his own lab to learn how to work with DNA. And then 6 years later, published a paper for which he then won the Nobel Prize in the discipline. And when he won it, he eventually won it as a geneticist, which he was learning on his sabbatical when he was 54, I think, basically. And his advice was, he liked that sort of bringing together of things. He was saying, you know, I'm not all the way at the cutting edge on any of these single things, but take your problem and learn new skills to apply to it, or take your skills and just take it to another problem that hasn't had those skills. And so he would advise his own students, like, do not try to be a clone of me or your thesis advisor. Like, that you can be a role model in other ways, but don't try to be a clone of that. And that's what I saw, at least in sports writing, was everyone was lining up to be the clone. And that's a hard way to compete, in my opinion.
Yeah, because then there's a very already established hierarchy with millions of people perhaps competing to be the top of that hierarchy. Yeah. And you just can't, that's really where 10,000 hours might come in. Like, when you need to be from the age of 3 on memorizing all sorts of sports statistics and, you know, starting writing about sports from an early age. And then, oh, okay, now that's the established hierarchy, and now I'm going to eventually be at the top. So that guy, Oliver, you mentioned, he created his own field, you know, based on the combining these two interests, and boom, of course he's going to be the best at it. Van Gogh created his own area of art. Like, if you look at one of his paintings, you know that's his, because that's his own personal style almost.
Yeah, I mean, as his Pulitzer Prize winning biographer said, he had to reinvent the rules in order to succeed, and so that's what he did.
I wonder if that's the key to success. So let's put this into almost like a formula. Let's say you're 50 or you're 30 or you're too old to start to be a prodigy, where you know, a prodigy maybe has different ways of building their brain and different uses for, you know, is better able to do 10,000 hour rule type domains. So let's say you're 30, 40, 50, you want to reinvent yourself. It seems like, again, taking a bunch of interests, what you've learned from all of them, what's the intersection of that? Like, this guy Oliver took medicine and chemistry and combine them for biochemistry, and then taking the domain you want to succeed in and sort of finding your own twist on the entire domain. Like you, let's just argue for a second, you created the area of scientific sports writing. Now, I'm sure there's other scientific sports writers, but you,
of course,
probably very few. And you basically sort of create or participate in this brand new domain that doesn't have millions of people competing to be on that hierarchy. And Van Gogh created his own area. So I've had Coolio, the rapper, on the podcast. And so he was breaking down for me, okay, in 1984, this is what rappers were like. In 1986, this is what rappers were like. In 1989, this is what rappers were like. And then in 1993, I decided I was going to add singing. So more kind of melodic harmony to rapping. So he kind of created his own area of that in an area that was already extremely popular. And the next year, Gangster's Paradise came out and was the number one song of the year. So that seems like a formula for success.
I know. I mean, yeah, I think you're better at doing the formulas than I did. So that was more eloquent than I would have put it, I think. But yeah, no, I love that. You talking about Coolio like that reminded me of one of my favorite studies called Superman or the Fantastic Four that was of comic book creators. I particularly liked it because, unlike a lot of business studies, it didn't suffer from survivor bias because the researchers could follow the value of comics up or down. And again, not that monetary value is the only thing, but it could track a whole industry and see who was most likely to produce blockbusters. And all of the hypotheses they had, to their credit, they listed were mostly wrong, that it would be the publisher's resources, amount of experience, and number of repetitions. But that's like because they were coming from analyzing industrial tasks in a kind environment, and those were all wrong. And it turned out it was the number of different genres that the creator had worked in that predicted their likelihood of making a breakthrough. And at a certain level, you could recreate a genre-diverse individual with a team. But once you got past four genres, an individual with more than four genres of experience could not be recreated anymore by platoon in a team. So there's some integration that an individual can do as that genre experience goes up that you can't necessarily do in a team. And I think that's the kind of thing, you know, that Coolio might be doing. He's doing this like integration of cross-genre forms that is difficult to recreate in any other way.
And then, you know, I wonder the role of experimentation. So let's say you love a certain domain and you want to get good at it quickly. You could say to yourself, okay, I'm going to take all these things I'm interested in. You could say, A, I don't have the 10,000 hours or the time. But I do have a lot of experiences that are kind of relatively similar. Here's how I can make the connection. So medicine and chemistry, there's some connection. There's some intersection there. Mm-hmm. Or science and sports writing, there's some connection. But it seems like another thing you have to do, and you mentioned this a little in the book, but I'm curious your thoughts on this. What's the role of trying different experiments to get better? So I'll just give you an example. When I was, and still am, trying to get better at something like totally new for me, like stand-up comedy, I'll try experiments. Like I'll go on a subway car and try to do stand-up comedy on the subway car. So I'll give myself a challenge that probably no one has done or does, just to sort of skip hours. That's the way I thought of it in my head, but maybe there's something else going on. But I thought I was like skipping hours by giving myself a challenge that no other comedian doing the traditional route would have done.
No, I think for sure, like you're doing the breadth of training predicts breadth of transfer. Like you want to do something new, right? And so you're going out and causing this broad training. And this is actually an area where I think some of the things I talk about and some of the things Anders talks about actually merge a little bit. Let's say like speed, when I was writing the sports gene, I was reading a bunch of speed typing literature, not the most scintillating stuff, but all of us, we get pretty good at typing and then we settle in at a good enough speed and we can get like twice as fast as whatever speed we settled at. But to require to do it, you have to like take a metronome, tick it up a little faster, follow that speed no matter how many mistakes you make and just go at that speed. And then you tick it up a little bit more and a little bit more and you can get like twice as fast. But it seems like our inclination with skills, if we do the same thing over and over, is to settle at like competent but not great. And the way that you get out of those ruts is basically to like totally vary up the challenge. And I think the more wicked the domain, the more you really have to vary that challenge. And I think absolutely you can skip ahead if you're doing that in a good way, because a lot of the things that other people are doing are like going to the gym and lifting the same number of weights the same time every day. You know, you won't slide backward, but you're not going to cause change and adaptation either.
Right. And the other thing I wonder about is you know, you mentioned this with the scientific research. If I write a paper and I cite sources that all the reviewers know, so I kind of stay very narrow in the domain, there's, again, some personality stuff going on. Like, oh, the reviewers say he's in our tribe. We'll bring him along slowly and eventually he'll rise up, as opposed to this guy who's quoting all sorts of crazy stuff from different domains. I wonder, you also have to have this psychology where you have to resist being in the tribe. So let's say you want to be the greatest chemist in the world. Well, you go to grad school and you're surrounded by all chemists and all the professors are chemists. So you want to be like them, and their professors were chemists. So there's like this very narrow path and tribe, but maybe to skip, there's a lot of pressures against going outside the tribe and bringing stuff back in.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, the interdisciplinary proposals are systematically docked.
So you have to have the psychology. Like, how do you get the psychology to say, I care so much about this, I'm going to ignore what the people I've admired for so many years expect from me, and I'm going to do something new?
Yeah, no, I don't know. I can only speculate about that, right? And I think one of the problems actually with interdisciplinary research being docked too is women are more likely to do it. So they end up getting systematically like docked in their reviews because they want to do interdisciplinary stuff. But I think it's just people following their interest. They must feel really strongly this is interesting because they're disincentivized from trying to do it in many ways, right? Those papers again end up in less prestigious journals. You have to wait to see their impact. They're harder to get funded. So they must think it's interesting.
You know, a modern example you bring up is Jordan Peele, who is making these great horror movies when his entire background was doing like comedy sketches. And he, you know, my guess is on both sides, like probably horror directors probably hated him for having like the top grossing horror movie of the year. And probably comedy people were like, what's he doing? Are they funny horror movies? Like, what's he doing? And he was just saying basically, you know, having studied both genres, that the beats were roughly the same.
Yeah.
And he could transfer knowledge from one to the other and rise to the top quickly in this other using this comedy kind of twist to things.
Right. So, I mean, he saw that commonality that it's all about like the timing of revealing information. And so he basically skipped all the way to the front of the line with his first movie.
Right. But he didn't say to himself, okay, well, the top of the tribe are these three comedy directors. Like, you know, I don't know who they are, Judd Apatow or whoever. And he didn't say, oh, I need to just follow their path because then I'll be respected among my peers that I've been around for the past 20 years.
Right.
He was willing to jump to another tribe and take skills from one and bring it to the other and skip the line of that whole tribe to make kind of a new domain in it and rise to the top.
Right. And I think it's amazing when those things happen because it happens in spite of a system that militates against it in every possible way, right? From the advice that people give about what to do to that sort of in-group that maybe doesn't want to let someone come up that quickly. And so what that says to me is it's so powerful that we should really diversify our pipeline for all endeavors, right? So one of the in Abby,
you have to diversify your tribes too.
Diversify the tribes too. And so Abby Griffin, a professor who studies serial innovators, people who repeatedly make creative contributions. When I was reading her research, it's like, you know, this staid language about like what people do, and then she sort of steps outside of that at one point and says, by the way, I'd like to give some advice to HR managers. When you make your job description too narrow, you're gonna accidentally screen out these serial innovators because they've jumped around disciplines. Maybe they have like some resume gaps. They have hobbies that you'll probably see as a diversion. They have a need to learn across domains. They tinker, all this kind of stuff. So her advice was, don't make that description or your development pipeline too narrow, or else you're going to screen out these people that we know have the highest potential for contributions because they're coming from places that you can't see, that you're not directly looking at. And so I think if we wanted to really like maximize human potential, we would do, and some national sports systems have done this, is they broaden their pipeline such that they can get people from a greater diversity of paths, which is a hard thing to systematize and say, this is the exact path we want. So instead you open up and allow more paths.
But that's looking at it from the top down. Like, okay, I want to hire the serial innovators. So look for people who have been able to jump from tribe to tribe to tribe and do modest innovations in each, and that's going to be my best hire. But now what if I'm bottom up? Like, what if you, so again, you did geology and sports writing, and you've written some books about sports and expertise, and you did scientific sports writing. What if now you said, oh, you know, I'm obsessed with romances. I want to write a great romance novel. Like, how would you approach starting to jump to the front of the line in romance novels?
I mean, when I got stuck with this book, this book was a real structural challenge for me. I took an online fiction writing course. And taking that, one of the things that happened, some of the assignments I had was to, you had to write an assignment using only dialogue. And then you had to write an assignment using no dialogue whatsoever. And after I did that, and you had to do assignments imitating certain voices and things. And after I did the one where you had to use no dialogue whatsoever, I went back through my manuscript of this book and was like, holy shit, like I need to strip a ton of quotes. I've been like leaning on quotes in a way that I didn't even realize I was doing because it's become so native to me. And somehow that like knocked me out of that and made me realize I was doing something without even thinking. And I went back and like completely changed the manuscript and wrote a lot of things where I was sort of leaning on quotes in a basically a lazy way. And so I would definitely take like some formal, more fiction classes, partly just because I loved it. But I know I have some strengths in organization of information. And that's a really important thing, no matter what you're doing in that kind of writing. And that would transfer for sure. So I think I would play to my strength by making one of the complexities of my novel in the structure, as opposed to some of the other aspects, because structure is something I already, like Jordan Peele with timing of reveal of informations is something that I can bring that I think people who have only gone in that genre are less likely to have had that same way.
Hmm. And then maybe, I don't know, the sports knowledge too, could be a sports romance.
Sure. I mean,
it's kind of the obvious thing too. So,
or a science romance. Or a sports science romance.
Yeah.
Then I'll really be on my own ground.
Yeah, then you're going to be the bestseller. You can make that category on Amazon.
50 Shades of Sports Science, that's
right.
Going straight to the top.
Yeah, actually, you can think about it. So some baseball player picks a fan out of the audience. Anyway. So one last thing about the 10,000-hour rule, because it does seem like we don't want to kind of completely discard that, although there's so many counterexamples and so many different, like, there's more domains that it seem to be largely wicked versus kind. But it does seem that when someone's young, there's a biological thing that happens when they put in repetition, which is that their brain starts transmitting signals among those neurons related to that domain much faster than if people start as adults. So, and I guess that happens in kind domains, but is that what contributes to the 10,000 hours for young people, or is there a way around that if you're trying to get good at chess, say, as an older person?
I mean, one of actually, Fernand Gobet said that, I know in some study when if people were sort of too rigid in the way they studied chess, he felt like they didn't get as good because they get locked in certain types of play patterns. So even within that, you want some variety. But it's totally bio-plausible to me. And was my intuition that you should start early, right? Because you've got this incredible brain plasticity and all these things. So when I was seeing these findings, starting in sports, that said, you are not the best, that are totally incompatible with the start as early as possible. If you want to do X, start in X exactly. They're totally incompatible with that. It just can't fit with that. And I think the theme, again, is that it's a question of, are you trying to automate these procedures, or are you trying to learn this broader skill of how you match certain types of strategies to certain types of problems? And I think if it's about automating procedures, or what in math they call using procedures knowledge, as opposed to this making connections knowledge, which is a much broader thing that's a framework instead of these myelinated automated processes, then it the way to take advantage of that plastic period is not by doing the same thing over and over. It's by building this breadth that becomes a scaffolding, and you can learn the more technical training later on.
And then the one last thing I'm curious about is, what's the role of charisma in all this? So it doesn't seem at first glance like there is a role, but again, since you're going against various tribes and you're trying to kind of create something new and then then have people notice it, you've got to be somehow, you have to be able to communicate that somehow. Like Claude Shannon, you bring up as a small example, but he created the whole study of information theory, but he was a juggler. He had all sorts of, tricks in his bag other things that he had studied, but he clearly had this kind of like over the top personality that attracted people to him.
Yeah.
So I wonder how much of a role that is in all of this.
No, that's a good question. I mean, I think it's incredibly important, and I can only speak to that totally subjectively, but But, you know, I think people have sort of different types of leadership traits that they can wield in that way, and that they should be aware of what their strengths are. And, you know, and like Susan Cain's written about this, like how do people use their native personality to be a source of power instead of a detriment. But like one of the inventors, a woman named Jayshree Seth, who I write about in Range, what she does, she's an inventor, and she went at 3M and she goes totally outside of her experience, even though everyone's telling her like you're crazy, you know, but she just doesn't want to do anymore what she was doing. And so she starts taking this approach because she's not specialized enough to do her own thing, starts like interviewing her colleagues in what she came to call her mosaic building process, where she does her homework about her own colleagues and says, this is one tile for the mosaic. And once she's got a full picture, she goes to them and says, she's integrating other people's work and says, this is the story. And if she does a good job, she finds that they are drawn onto her team. And so I don't know that that was necessarily pure charisma, but it was finding a way to do your homework in a way and create an engaging vision for a number of people that they want to be drawn onto your team.
Well, David Epstein, author of Range. By the way, the top quote on the cover is from Malcolm Gladwell. He says, I loved Range, just like a very simple—
The full quote is really funny.
Well, what's the full quote? Oh, wait, okay. Here's the full quote. For reasons I cannot explain, David Epstein manages to make me thoroughly enjoy the experience of being told that everything I thought about something was wrong. I loved Range. Malcolm Gladwell.
Very kind of him.
And Maria Konnikova, Sebastian Junger, Susan Cain,
all of our friends.
And Daniel Pink, all quotes on the back. Well, congratulations on this. When did the book come out?
Tuesday.
Oh, just this past Tuesday?
Yep.
I probably got it.
You're just on the VIP list.
Or maybe I bought it after Maria sent me the email. I don't know. Maria sent me an email like a few months ago. Need to meet this guy. And I was so bogged down with podcasts then. But I probably ordered the book and then got it the day it came out. And then I started reading it.
Did you get it on Tuesday? I tried to send you a copy earlier, like an advanced copy. Whatever, it doesn't matter.
I don't know. This is the copy I got. This is not an advanced copy.
Okay.
It doesn't have the usual advanced stuff on it. I got this the day it came out and I figured, oh, I got nothing to do today. I'm going to read this book.
Okay. All right.
And I didn't know that I knew you, and you know, at least through emails. And then I'm like, oh my gosh, this is the exact thing I've been trying to figure out. So it's such a great book. And then it's great to be able to talk to you about it. So thanks for coming on the podcast.
It's my pleasure. I mean, to hear you sort of synthesize some of the ideas in areas and domains that I didn't even write about is hugely instructive for me. And so I really enjoy that.
Oh, well, let's keep in touch and come on again at some point.
I'd love to.
Excellent. Thanks.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.